So it's good to be here. It's always fun to talk to a new audience, and I've never been to USENIX before. I've been to a bunch of different security conferences. There's different audiences at different security conferences, and so it'll be interesting to see kind of the questions that you guys keep. I'm going to try and keep a bunch of time at the end for questions, because inevitably people have lots of issues that they're interested in that I don't cover. But for now, basically, I want to kind of start with a broad overview. I'm going to start out much less specific and just talk about web browsers and browser security in general. I'll be talking about kind of how we designed Internet Explorer 8 and where we think the threats are and where we think the future is going to go to a lesser degree. But first, I kind of want to set context, because it's helpful to have you guys understand kind of where we're coming from in the browser space. So, as you mentioned, I'm a program manager for security. Before that, I was a program manager for networking and trust. I've established my geek bona fides with a license plate. Some of you may have heard of some of the tools that I've written. I wrote a tool called Fiddler, which is a pretty popular web debugger. And then there's some prior tools called Tamper IE, for instance, which is a tool that allows you to easily penetration test forms on websites and so forth. So I want to give some contextual history, and this will really be kind of my story in IE. So in IE, I joined back before Internet Explorer 7 started, and I worked on some security features after doing some security work in Office. And when my team heard that I was going to go to IE, they said, wow, that sounds like a really good fit, because security is really something that Internet Explorer needs. Remember, this was back in the days of XP. SP2 had just shipped, so that was a good first step in the browser security, but clearly we had a ton of work to do. And Internet Explorer 7, we did a bunch of that work, and we'll talk about some of those features because they carry through to Internet Explorer 8. But the main point about how IE7 security was our goal was to reduce attack surface against the local machine, because at the time, that was really kind of the thing that was of interest to everyone. Compromise the local machine, get malware on the local machine, infect the local machine, and that's the end of the game. And that's really still interesting to attackers, but the story has gotten more complicated, and we'll talk about why that is and so forth. But as we said, attackers aren't static. And so there's a bunch of new things that we worry about as we entered into Internet Explorer 8. First was web application attacks, the alphabet soup of attacks, cross-site request forgery, cross-site scripting, some new attacks, clickjacking, HTTP response splitting. All of these things promised to be, a great new vector for bad guys to do attacks against websites. And this is of interest because more and more high-value information is moving to the web. Compromising an end user's local machine may not be terribly interesting if none of the information that they care about is on that local machine, it's all up in the cloud. And so if my bank information, my stock information, my email, all of this stuff lives in the cloud, I need not, get your local machine in order to get access to your information. I can just attack those websites directly. And unfortunately, very often, I can use your browser to do it. And so we're going to talk about some of the mitigations we have in place for the attacks against websites. The other problem is we start to see social engineering continuing to increase in terms of its relevance to the threat model on the web. And we've got some features there as well. The next thing, and this is almost more forward-looking, is how the web platform itself is getting much richer. And so with things like HTML5 and the new specs that are out there that are trying to make the web platform competitive with desktop applications, we're increasing significantly the attack surface for attackers to go after the browser. And so we have to be very clear that as we make the browser more powerful, that we're not increasing the security attack surface. And then the last point is basically just that interest in security research, both for good and evil, continues to grow. And we've seen actually some really impressive work from very young people. One of the stories I like to tell, Microsoft has a security conference called Blue Hat, and we invite researchers from around the world to come to Blue Hat and talk about things. One of the researchers we had was from, I think he was either from Australia or New Zealand, and he came out. And, they wanted to take all the researchers out, for drinks after the conference. And unfortunately, he couldn't come because he wasn't of age in the United States, which is 21. And so we thought, oh, well, that's easy. We'll just drive up to Vancouver, right, because the drinking age is 19 there. Well, it turns out he's not 19 either. And so, he couldn't come to our drinks event, unfortunately, because he was underage. For a while, Internet Explorer actually had an intern who was on our security test team who actually had to have his mom come out and live with him for the summer because he wasn't legally allowed to work in Washington State without an adult guardian present. So the point here is that, the bar for entry as a penetration tester or a security researcher is quite low because so much of this stuff is unexplored terrain. And as we get more and more eyes on this problem, we see more and more attacks. And we'll talk about some of the interesting challenges we have in patching and closing those holes. The biggest problem, however, I would say for the overall security of the web is that it turns out that crime actually pays incredibly well. And what this means is that bad guys have a tremendous incentive, and particularly in parts of the world where job opportunities are not quite the same as they are, to actually go out and make a business out of exploiting people. So it's not about the script kiddies or defacing sites. It's about people who are actually have an actual business incentive to build reliable exploits that they deploy to lots and lots of people. And so, you know, one of the things that when I was writing this slide that had come up was there was this discussion of, you know, Microsoft is offering a reward of, I think, $250,000 US for helping the FBI catch one of the purveyors of one of the prominent worms. And, you know, there was this thought that, oh, you know, somebody's going to turn on their accomplices and turn them all in and collect the money. And it turned out that at the time, I think they had concluded that the $250,000 that was being rewarded was the current monthly take of that particular worm. And so nobody's really going to, you know, turn in their compatriots if they're able to clear that much money every month. And so the financial aspect of things is really interesting. But it also speaks to a different type of approach for solving the problem. If we can raise the cost for attackers such that they won't be making the kinds of profits they are, we can actually reduce their prevalence. And so there's a bunch of things that we do that aren't perfect mitigations, but the goal is to raise the bar. So, why is browser security so elusive? Or as my mom likes to ask, why aren't you done yet? Haven't you been working on this for a while? And the answer is there's a bunch of different factors that work together. The first, and I think the most interesting one in the web app security space, is just simply the complexity. The way that the different pieces of the web platform interact is not terribly well understood, even by people who are professionals in the space. And so it's really interesting to go out and read people's descriptions of, for instance, same origin policy on the web, because it turns out that most web developers don't even really understand what same origin policy means. And this gets really important as we extend the web platform, as rich internet frameworks are built on top of the web platform. Because if the people that are designing these frameworks don't understand what the same origin policy means in the browser, it means that their plugins aren't likely to implement it in the same way. And anytime you have differing implementations of the basic security concepts, you run into this complexity problem where these components interact. And so we've seen some talks recently about people who are attacking that type of misunderstanding of the web security model. And so the complexity of the interaction is one of the key things that we deal with. In a lot of ways, the security architecture of the web platform was an afterthought, things that were basically bolted on. There were some brilliant people in the early web design who actually came up with some models that were very, very interesting, but they're also very different than desktop models in some cases, and they weren't terribly well understood by everyone. And the original implementations of browsers didn't enforce even those principles very well. And so you ended up with cases where if you look back at the history of browser patching between, say, 1995 and 2001, basically browser after browser, oh, yet another exploit, let's go patch this. But back in the early days, it was relatively okay that you had this kind of reactive model where they would plumb in security once they realized, oh, there's actually a hole, because there wasn't really all that much of interest going on in the web at the time. If you had a cross-domain violation in the web in 1996 or 1997, it was kind of like, oh, look, I can read your iframe, who cares? Well, now that's actually critical, right? Because that same origin policy is one of the core principles that keeps the bad guy's website from reading your bank's website. And so a lot of the security model problems we have are related to the fact that, you know, there wasn't this big design up front that came to a design that we would really like. And so we've had a bunch of people propose, I've got a new web security model. It's going to be cool. It's going to be very clear, very understandable, and solve all the confusion in the current web security model. All we need to do is get every website to change, and then we'll update. And of course, that's just never going to fly. And so we have to find a way to work within the existing model, strengthen the existing model, and try and ensure that as we build a stronger and richer web platform, that we don't make the same mistakes going forward. So I'm a program manager, which means that pretty much by definition, I'm lazy. I try and look for shortcuts as much as possible because, you know, I want to make my job simpler. And there's lots of interesting problems in the world. You know, web security is one of them, but it would be cool to solve that one and go work on something else. So, you know, when you start IE8, we say, hey, maybe there's a shortcut. And it turns out we can block almost 100% of the meaningful exploits on the web today if we just remove one vulnerable component from the system. Well, it turns out that component is actually pretty important for the system being useful, right? You know, the fact that you can get to any site on the internet, you know, just by typing a URL or getting a redirection from someone, end up pretty much anywhere in the world is tremendously powerful. Brings the world together like never before. The problem is that there's a lot of things that locality prevents that, you know, aren't prevented in the internet world. I never accidentally wake up in the morning and walk down the street to a bank in Romania and think it's my bank and, you know, give them my account information. But that's entirely possible on the web today, right? Because, you know, some fisher somewhere in the world is just as local as your local bank. And so locality is something that we can't rely on. So, you know, we can't get rid of the network cable because, you know, all of the goodness out of the web comes there. I can't go, you know, visit sites that I care about around the world and learn interesting things from people I'll never meet if I pull the network cable. But at the same time, it presents a tremendous threat. And so we have to find a way within the constraint of, you know, not relying on these things to continue to be secure. Well, as we look at the attacks that are in play in the real world today, we also find that we can block a majority of the exploits if we just remove one other component from the system. The user. Right? Well, that's, you know, a nice thing to think. Maybe we can just get rid of the user and then everything will be good. But of course, if we take all of the decisions out of the hands of the user is probably not going to be very happy. In some cases, it may be the best thing to do, and we'll talk about that in just a sec. But in some cases, basically, if you take a security decision away from the user, they're going to say, your product doesn't really respect my choice to do what I want, so I'm not going to use it. I'm going to use a different product. And I don't care if it's less secure. I know what I'm doing. I'm going to use it. It's kind of interesting. I was at a security conference, RSA, and one of the folks at a three-letter government agency came to us, and they said, you know, how do we secure the platform, right? It would be great if I could just take out the user. And it was kind of funny because he kind of made the take out motion when he was doing it. And it was like, yeah, that's clearly not going to fly. But there is actually a way that you can take the user out of the equation, and we'll get to that. But for now, where are we? Well, if we re-architect everything, get rid of the users, or get rid of the network, we can make everything secure. Clearly, none of these things is actually going to be successful. So we have to figure out how can we be successful within those constraints. Security is straightforward, is something I've been saying lately, because security itself is actually pretty interesting. It's an interesting problem because we mostly know what to do, right? Reduce attack surface, remove points of entry, make everything more secure. Well, the problem is it's the trade-offs that are complicated, because very often we run into cases where we make things more secure, and overall, for the safety of our users, their net safety goes down. And that's kind of a weird paradox, but it's something that we saw very vividly after we shipped IE7, and it continues to be a problem. People have this idea that we're Microsoft, we can just push the world, right? We're a big, influential company, we've got huge market share in the browser space and in the operating system space. If we went out and just made everything secure, the world would be better, right? Customers don't want it, who cares? Force it on them. There's a hilarious thread going on the IE blog right now where our general manager said, yeah, you know, we're gonna continue to support Internet Explorer 6 because our customers want us to. And the response is generally like, what? You're crazy. Like, just dump it. Who cares if your customers want it? Who cares if you're committed to supporting it, you know, for years now? Just dump it, because the web would be more secure. And then the IT managers write in and they're like, no, I've got 10,000 desktops and my users don't go anywhere, so it's all safe. And so we have this really interesting interplay where basically people have this idea that we can just move the web, and it just doesn't work like that. The internet is huge. There's, you know, billions of web pages, hundreds of millions of users. This is a problem where we can't just go out and say, we have seen the light, we're going the right way, everyone follow us. And so we have to work with standards bodies. We have to work with other browsers to try and figure out how can we move forward the web together in a way that it doesn't break most of the things that make the web valuable and interesting today. There's a bunch of challenges for us in particular around just changing anything. And one of them is, you know, we have hundreds of millions of users, and so you saw the numbers yesterday from Rich Cannings about the number of internet users in the world and how it's increasing, and some of those are going to the mobile platform, but certainly there's hundreds and hundreds of millions on the desktop platform, soon to surpass the billion mark. And so we've got tons of users. We have lots of people that say, nobody I know uses this feature, take it out. It's like, well, how many people do you know? 10,000? You know? That just leaves a billion. So we can't just do things based on sort of local thoughts about how things ought to work. Secondly, we've got users all over the world. There's certain concepts that, you know, may be very clear in certain parts of the world and less clear in other parts of the world. Great example of this for me was when the Firefox guys were introducing their security UX. They have the guy, they call him Larry, the security guy, and he's like this little passport control officer. And there was concern that, well, in certain parts of the world, you know, people in uniform are very, very scary, and you don't want to go anywhere near those people. And so, you know, even the UX metaphors are very tricky because of the worldwide nature of things. billions and billions of web pages. This is one of the most interesting challenges because as much as we've got a view of the web, the public web, there's a huge part of the web that isn't public, people's intranets. And if we make changes that, you know, we scanned the web, we crawled the web, we didn't find any pages that would be impacted or a very small number that would be impacted, well, there's this huge part of the web that we just don't see. And so if we break customers' intranets, they're not likely to want to use our product. There's ways that we can try and segment parts of it and say, well, if we think it's the internet, it should be a little less secure or, you know, a little more forgiving, but it's a very challenging problem to deal with. And the one that I think the Chrome guys have done very effectively recently is they pointed out that most people don't know what a browser even is. And I had my own example of this. I was in an airport in Orlando, and I was carrying my Microsoft backpack, and the woman behind me came up to me, and she says, oh, you work for Microsoft. What do you do there? And I said, oh, hi, I work on IE. And she looks at me and says, well, what's an IE? And I said, oh, sorry, Internet Explorer. And she goes, oh, what's Internet Explorer? And I said, oh, I'm sorry, I work on the web browser. And she goes, well, what's the web browser? And I said, you know the little blue E on your desktop that you click on to get to the internet? And she goes, oh yeah, you work on that? And she really knew what I was talking about. I was like, yeah. And she's like, so you work for Google? And basically I just said, yeah, kinda. And so there's this problem, right, where we have this idea in the browser world, and particularly in the browser community, we have this idea of, oh, everybody should just get on the latest version. They should totally understand what's going on. We did a survey. You know, we had one of our UX guys go to, you know, do some site visits. And, you know, he was talking to users about, you know, kind of phishing attacks. And he asked, well, you know, this page is clearly not legitimate. And they looked at it, and they're like, no, no, it's got the logo, and there's a little lock in the page and so forth. And he's like, well, but look at the address bar. And I said, what's the address bar? And he's like, how did you get here? Well, you know, I started my browser, and then I typed a URL in the box. Can you show me? They boot the browser, they go to the Google homepage, and they type the URL in the Google search box, click go, and click the first result. They had no concept of the security UI in the address bar, right? And for a normal person, maybe they just don't need to, right? They don't understand the basic principles and concepts of the programs that they're using. And so, unfortunately, this is something that we have to either figure out a way where it's not important anymore or educate the user. And as people, you know, this audience in particular, I think, is probably determined pretty well through study after study, educating users is very, very tricky. Another point to make is that the web is surprisingly fragile. And this is something which is kind of amazing when you think about it, because the web, you know, is all built around these text protocols, very forgiving parsers. You know, the web ought to be really forgiving of bad content and changes and updates, and everything should just kind of seamlessly move. But it's not that at all. An example I gave to somebody yesterday was we actually made a change in the browser about a year ago. There was a major, you know, institution that came to us and said, hey, Internet Explorer only supports 20 cookies per hostname on the web. And, you know, we just bought and acquired another company, and they've merged their website into ours. And we really need to support 24 cookies. And by the way, all of your competitors who have, you know, such and such a market share support 50 cookies. So you should be cool like them. And we said, man, we really don't want to do this, but we keep hearing this. You know, okay, fine, what's the harm? We'll increase the cookie limit from 20 to 50. Easiest change ever. We're changing one number in the source code, 20 to 50. 3 days after we shipped the patch, we get the critical call from the bank in Japan that has found that nobody can use their website anymore. It turns out that this bank had this crazy dependency in their source where if they got more than 20 cookies, they simply just didn't work at all. And apparently all of their users were using Internet Explorer. They were relying on this artifact that wasn't part of anything, you know, any part of the promise that we make in IE, but they were relying on this artifact and they were completely broken. Now in that case, we actually didn't revert the change because once we actually ship a change to customers, we tend to be pretty committed and dedicated to it. But it's a very significant challenge for us because anytime we consider touching anything in the platform, we have to be super, super careful. And that's one of the reasons why you primarily are going to see new security investments in future versions of the browser. We don't bring them back to, you know, IE6, which we first shipped 8 years ago, for the reason that people expect their stuff to just work. And if we break it, what will happen? Well, a lot of people think, oh, well, they'll be really mad at you and they'll update their websites. No. They'll stop installing patches because patches are bad. They break things. So we have to be very, very cognizant of that. For most web users, whether it's the end user, whether it's the business that's deploying the browser that they're running, or the website, it's all about value, right? It's also all about value to the bad guys, because they're interested in the financial side of things too. But it's very difficult for us to make anybody move unless they've got a business reason to do so. And so we have to make sure that as we're adding things to the browser to make them more secure, we're doing it in a way that's very cognizant of the fact that if we impair their business, if we hurt their customers' ability to use their sites, people just will not recommend our browser. They'll actually actively recommend less secure browsers. And so we have to be very careful with that too. If you ask users what kind of browser you want, they'll say, I want a really fast browser. I want it to be minimal. I don't care about the browser. I just care about my websites. It should be super, super fast. And you know, I don't need any of your whiz-bang features. I don't want any prompts or dialogues or security things. I just want everything to be super, duper fast. And I don't want anything bad to happen to me. Oh, and incidentally, I'm going to take this browser to all untrusted websites all over the world, and I want these things to be true. So this represents the browser that people are asking for. This is the browser that people expect, right? Something that's, you know, heavily armored. There can be an active attacker who's out to get you, and they just can't hurt you. They can throw every attack in the book at you, and nothing bad happens to you, right? So we have to find some way to build a browser with this kind of level of protection while it still feels like the fast sports car that goes everywhere you want. And this, of course, is a pretty significant challenge as well. Another thing about security that's really challenging is the bad guys only need to find one way to get in. Whereas the browser security side of things, we have to cover everything. If there's one hole, then everybody's like, oh, wow, your browser's terrible, man. You've got that hole. We're like, but look at all the places we don't have holes. And they say, we don't care. The attackers will go after the holes, right? And so as playing defense is always very hard. You know, it's nice to think about an offensive browser where if it detects the site is trying to hack you, it hacks back. That would be kind of fun. Maybe a good research project, but not, unfortunately, something that we could ever ship. So what do we do in IE8? The security team's investments focused in three major areas: security feature improvements, secure features, and security and compatibility. Security feature improvements is basically the checkboxes that we put on the box. In IE7, it was protected mode and ActiveX opt-in and so forth. In IE8, we did security features like per-site ActiveX and a bunch of other features, the XSS filter and so forth, that we're going to spend most of this talk talking about. The next part, and a growing part, is secure features. And this is really interesting. We added a ton of functionality to IE8, but we knew that if we added functionality at the same rate that we previously used to add security bugs, we'd be less secure even though we invested in security. So we had to make sure that all of the features we do are either, you know, net positive to security or at least not net negative. And so we did a bunch of features. We added a bunch of functionality in the browser, which isn't security related, but over time will actually make the user more secure. And I'll talk about some of those features in a minute too. And then last point I've kind of harped on quite a bit is security and compatibility. Went to a major web property after we shipped IE7, told them about all the great security work we'd done, much of which they had asked us for. And we said, you know, are we doing everything we can for you guys? And they said, well, you know, your talk was really neat. And I said, well, okay, well, is there anything we missed? Anything we can add? And they're like, no, that feature set's great. I'm like, you guys don't seem very excited to have this. And the response was, well, it doesn't really matter. And I said, well, why not? They're like, well, all of our users use IE6, so even if you've got this more secure product, who cares? And I was like, well, why do your users use IE6? Oh, well, they tell us that it's, you know, compatible with the sites they care about. There's still tons of sites that refuse to use IE7. And so this was one of the things that was really challenging for us, because in IE7, we made very few changes to the web platform. We fixed a couple of CSS bugs. Well, for IE8, we added full CSS 2.1 support and a ton of other fixes. And that's going to break sites. And if we break sites, then people won't upgrade. So we have to be very, very careful in the compatibility side of things that we don't cause anything that would prevent adoption of the new browser or none of the security benefits are seen. And that includes security features. We had some great security proposals on the table for IE8 that would make our users more secure. The problem is they'd also break sites. And if they break sites, then people won't install the browser and get all of the other security goodness. So we have to make sure that we're highly compatible as we add new features. Our threat focus area was broken up into three things: the browser and add-on vulnerabilities, social engineering attacks, and web application vulnerabilities. And that's going to be pretty much the bulk of the rest of the talk. Maybe at the end I'll get to a couple of privacy things, just because it's interesting to people in the security space. Problem number one, ActiveX. There's generally this perception that back in the 90s, ActiveX was this horrible, horrible technology that was really, really insecure and people were really put at risk. That's kind of true. ActiveX code quality in the 90s was abysmal. The problem is that you know, most of the time, most of those controls weren't very broadly deployed. And so the actual impact on users was fairly low. Well, now you've got mega sites with hundreds of millions of users that all deploy ActiveX controls to their users for doing things like upload and, you know, various rich parts or media playback and things like that. And so ActiveX code quality, while better, is still a huge problem. And so this is the CVE, I think it was from 2007, of the vulnerabilities that were found in that year. And as you can see, Microsoft ActiveX controls, even though we're probably one of the bigger purveyors of them, relatively low number of vulnerabilities. But in the industry as a whole, it's a huge number. So we looked at this chart and said, man, no matter what we do in Internet Explorer security, if we've got this gaping hole, we're going to have a real problem. So what do we do? Well, we've had this concept of a gauntlet from the beginning of IE. Originally in IE, there was very little in the way of ActiveX security safety. You'd ask the control, hey, you good to run in the browser? And the control says yes, and then that was the end. The control runs. We've got native code execution. Well, over the years, we've kind of plugged in additional things. And you know, one of the logical questions is, why don't you just pull out ActiveX to begin with? Well, people wouldn't upgrade. People wouldn't use it. The number of people that have said, you guys need to get rid of ActiveX, all I need is, you know, just HTML. And we say, well, do you like YouTube? And they say, yeah. And you say, well, what do you think that works with? What do you think Flash is? Okay, you could take a different plugin model, a different native code plugin model, but now you've got a different native code plugin model. So what we did, first things first, we had this concept of kilobits. So if a site or vendor realizes, oops, we shipped a control with vulnerability, they can work with the Microsoft Security Response Center and actually get that control killed. So it won't instantiate on users' machines anymore. Very dumb, it's very simple, it's reactive, not proactive, but it's something that's out there and prevents misuse of controls that are just, you know, broken. The second part has existed forever. It's an interface called iObject Safety. That's basically the way for the browser to query the ActiveX control. Hey, are you meant to run on the web? And the control can either say yes or no. We've got a template that's built on a technology that allows you to do what's called site locking. So very easily, you can add this template to your code and say, I'm only allowed to run on certain sites. Site locking reduces your attack surface by a tremendous degree because that means that your Dell system profiler control, for instance, can't be used by evil.com. And so it's a great attack surface reduction. The problem with site lock is it turns out that virtually nobody outside of Microsoft uses site lock. And so that's going to speak to a feature that we're going to get to at the very end. The next feature, the feature that we added that was probably the biggest attack surface reduction we did in IE7, is called ActiveX Opt-in. A given ActiveX control, a given machine out of an OEM with a full set of their typical utilities and so forth on it, contained roughly 100 ActiveX controls. Well, it turns out that many of those controls really weren't intended on the web, but were marked in such a way that potentially they could be used on the web. What ActiveX opt-in did was, in IE7 and in IE8, when you first use an ActiveX control that just happened to be installed in the system, not installed through the browser, we actually just block it by default. And we tell the user, hey, this page wants to use this control that was previously installed on your system, but, you know, that's kind of a little dodgy, so we're just going to block it by default. So we took the attack surface of the browser by default out of the box down from, you know, 100 or so ActiveX controls to maybe 10. And those 10 were carefully selected based on objective criteria for use on the web, things that were intended for use on the web, things like Flash and RealPlayer and QuickTime and so forth. And so that was a big attack surface reduction. But it turned out it's not enough. And the reason it's not enough is because a lot of people get ActiveX controls off the web that are meant to run on the web. Great example is a major site's music engine. Their music engine was basically a media playback technology. As discussed yesterday, media playback is an area that's really ripe for fuzzing bugs, and actually lots of sites and controls and so forth have them. Well, the music engine control had such a bug, and so if you fed it a malformed media file, it would result in remote code execution. Had they used site lock, it could only be used on their site, but they hadn't. So that meant that any site on the web could attack any user of this software that had the ActiveX control installed, and they would be exploited with zero clicks. So what we did in IE8 is we introduced what's called per-site ActiveX. The way per-site ActiveX works is that by default, an ActiveX control can only install from the site that gave it to you, which means that if you go to, you know, in this case, somewhereshady.example.com, and it tries to kick off the Microsoft Office authorization control, it's not going to work. It's blocked by default. And this, again, reduces the attack surface, scopes down the accessibility of ActiveX to help prevent those exploits. Got a bunch of other things that we did in IE8. So as alluded to yesterday by Alexander Sadarov's talk, we've turned on data execution prevention in IE8. We couldn't do it in IE7 because compatibility. Compatibility problems were that most ActiveX controls are written in a technology called ATL. Previous versions of ATL, Visual Studio 2003 and earlier, weren't compatible with DEP. So if you wrote an ActiveX control, it would trigger the DEP exception and crash. And so we couldn't turn DEP on. Well, for IE8, what we did is we worked with the Windows kernel team to actually change the Windows kernel so that there's something called ATL funk emulation. So if we detect a DEP violation is occurring, but it's because of an ATL funk emulation, we emulate, or an ATL funk, we will emulate that funk so that DEP doesn't fire. So what this means is that we can turn on data execution prevention. This is a huge mitigation in the browser because not only does it shield the browser itself, it also shields all of the code running in the browser. So if you've got an ActiveX control that was written and it has a buffer overflow or something, DEP is there to help protect against that vulnerability. We've also turned on address space layout randomization for all the controls within or on everything that's part of Internet Explorer. And we've worked with vendors of popular ActiveX controls to make sure that they're using ASLR as well. We compile with the safe SEH thing to prevent structure exception handler overwrites. We use GS and so forth. So basically, we've opted into the alphabet soup of mitigations that can be done by the compiler. One of the things that Alexander mentioned yesterday was that, you know, safe SEH has this big hole in it because everybody has to use it. So we're out there trying to evangelize to all the ActiveX developers, hey, you really need to use safe SEH because it's putting everybody at risk. Well, Windows 7 has a really cool feature that allows you to opt a process on a process-by-process basis into the feature called CHOP. CHOP is something that doesn't require recompiling of controls. And so there's actually a blog post from the Security Research and Defense Guys explaining how to turn CHOP on for the Internet Explorer process. On Windows Vista SP2, you can actually turn it on for all processes on the system, but there's some compatibility issues with some obscure utilities, and so it's not on by default. But this is the direction that we're moving, is working in more and more into these mitigations that are becoming available in the operating system and opting into as many of them as we can without impacting compatibility. Because again, as soon as we impact compatibility, people don't upgrade. If people don't upgrade, they don't benefit from anything else we're talking about today. IE7 introduced a concept of protected mode. Protected mode is a sandbox, basically, where we have a low integrity process which is responsible for most of the interactions that you have on the internet. And so the way that it works is basically you've got a low integrity process and a medium integrity process. We did some modifications of this in the IE8 timeframe. The general idea is the outer window, the browser window, the Chrome, and so forth, runs in a medium integrity process, and then the tab actually runs in a low integrity process. Well, what this means is that if you have an exploit within the browser process, either in the JavaScript sandbox or in an ActiveX control that's running in the process and so forth, by default, it's in this low integrity process. This low integrity process doesn't have permissions to write to the system. So you can't write to the registry, you can't write to the file system. And the idea is to help mitigate the attacks where, you know, back in the day you had these drive-by attacks that would find a vulnerability in the browser, get a code execution, use that code execution to make a persistent change to the user's configuration. So the sandboxing here is pretty good at preventing exploit of the local system, but it's a one-way thing. It's preventing write to the system. It's not preventing reads out of the system. The logical answer is, why not? And the answer is, again, compatibility. It turns out that significant majority of the ActiveX controls that exist out there have the expectation that they can pull things out of the system, whether they're uploading files or getting the flash local storage or, you know, any other thing. They need the ability to read from the system. And so if we built a system that blocked reads as well, people wouldn't upgrade. So protected mode continues on in IE8. We've made some improvements because we have this new loosely coupled architecture that allows tabs of different integrity levels to run within one browser window. So we got rid of one of the big user experience pains. We've done some minor API work and so forth. But protected mode is a feature which, you know, is often not talked about in the security community because we don't make the same level of guarantees about protected mode as we do about some of our other security features. But it's an additional hurdle for a bad guy to jump if he wants to actually make a configuration change to your machine. Okay, here's a question for the audience. What's the best way to develop secure, performant, and reliable C and C++ code? What? Hey, you cheated. Yes. Usually the answer I hear is like, use Java, use C#. The answer is, of course, just don't, right? And to that end, okay, well, you know, as we've talked before, Microsoft just can't push everybody to do the right thing and say, thou shalt not. What we have to do is provide a compelling alternative. And the compelling alternative that we did in Internet Explorer 8 is we added a bunch of non-binary extensibility mechanisms. The first is accelerators. Accelerators allow you to easily just create a little XML package where the user can say, install this accelerator. There's no third-party code that's running, no C, C++ code, no setup code, no need to run as admin to install. And what it does is it enhances the context menu with new services that are available. And those services can be fairly rich. So they can hook up to a web service, provide previews. This is an accelerator for Map with Live Search, but you can do this for any mapping engine. And the idea is to get out of things that used to previously require the user to install code. Because very often that code would run all the time, and usually it wasn't terribly high quality, and it often wasn't updated very often. And so it became a performance and reliability and security nightmare. So accelerators are the first thing that we did. The next thing we did is web slices. One of the things that we saw was a lot of websites would build a toolbar, and the primary reason that the toolbar existed was to take up parts of the user's screen and persistently remind the user, hey, we're foo.com and you like us, come to us. So what we created in IE8 is what's called web slices. Web slices allow the user to just hover over part of the page, click a little button, and put it in their favorites bar. And so what happens is essentially you get this little tear off part of the web page that appears within the user's favorites bar and can show them information they care about. In this case, I've got a weather one, which is showing the weather in San Jose. I forgot to update it for Montreal. But you could imagine, eBay, if you monitor an auction, it can show you the current price and so forth. And the key point here, again, is that this is all about, this. In this case, it's all about CSS. There's no third-party code that's running here. If the user wants to get rid of one of these things after he's not interested anymore, he just right-clicks it and clicks delete. There's nothing lingering on the system, no registry changes. And so again, a more compelling alternative than what people had to do previously. Because it's not actually easy to write Internet Explorer extensions. And so if we provide a more compelling alternative, the goal is to move the ecosystem. These are both new features, but net-net, we think they reduce the attack surface in the system because A, we were really careful when we made them, and B, they're more compelling alternatives to something that was available previously. We also have a feature called visual search suggestions. One of the common things we saw was people would build search toolbars, and the search toolbars would have a couple of features, but the primary thing that they had was the ability to suggest searches based on what you'd typed. Well, we have a search box in IE, let's just make it better. So this queries an XML service and allows the search provider to provide suggestions. So in this case, as you type weather, it suggests some searches related to weather, things that you've searched for previously, and can even do these visual search suggestions where it'll show you images. And so if you search for pictures or whatever, it can give you thumbnails. Okay, next part of the talk. I've been to a few security talks. One of the things I've realized is that in a security talk, it's almost impossible to get any degree of thunderous applause from an audience unless you manage to get code running. I went to a talk in Hack in the Box in Malaysia, and this guy was picking on internet kiosks. And he had just a little toolkit with like 15 different buttons, and he pushed the first button and a shell would appear, and the audience would go, yeah! And he pushed the second button, same thing, and it was like, yeah! And so basically that's what he was doing. And I was like, man, this guy is getting a tremendous reaction from the audience. I want to show what an elite hacker I am. I want to get that reaction. So I'm going to show my elite hacker demo of what I consider to be the easiest way to get code execution on the user's browser. Now, this is not going to work terribly well if I have no internet connection, so let's go make sure that I have a nice, wonderful internet connection. And if this doesn't work, I've got an offline cached version, and if that doesn't work, well, I'm just going to be terribly embarrassed. Okay. So, in my opinion, the easiest way to get code execution in the browser is as follows. And I would like to point out that for the purposes of this demonstration, we're going to launch Calculator, everyone's favorite application for doing these demos. And so I'm going to visit a website, and the website is going to say, check out these crazy photos that authority figure so-and-so doesn't want you to see, whether that's wife, mom, dad, teacher, and so forth. They'll blow your mind. Click on the link to see crazy photos. I want that, okay, give me that, give me that, give me that. Oh, calculator runs! Yay! Now, it's ridiculous and stupid, but the reality is that you don't need crazy, stack, heap, manipulations, and so forth to get code running. The best way to get code running on the user's machine is say, hey user, run this code. And they'll say, okay, let me do that. So what can we do about this problem? Again, taking out the user is probably not a good option. Now, There's been a bunch of security press recently about, I think it was Bruce Schneier who pointed out that, you know, users aren't wired to make good security decisions in the information security realm. And too many people have simplified that into users don't make good security decisions. Well, I can pretty much guarantee you that even the most average user in the world, if you showed them a boat full of alligators and said, jump in, they'd say, you know, I don't think I'm going to do that, right? And so in nature, nature has adapted. They've said, we need to do a little bit more than that. So they hide a little. They make it harder to see the attack. And what you'll see is that web attackers are starting to do this as well. Back in the old days, you tell the user, go download this random thing, and everybody would do it. Now certain people will say, maybe not. And so attackers are getting more and more clever. Fake codecs and add-ons. There was a huge media article about this recently where I guess there was some journalist from CNN and there was some video or something and it was going around the web and everybody wanted to see this video. And so you send all this spam mail saying, hey, I've got that crazy video that you wanted to see. Or, hey, you know, I've got a crazy video of your friend from Facebook that they didn't want to get on the internet and you come visit my page and see it. And when you visit that page, basically you get a little pop-up that says, you know, you need a new version of Flash to see this content. You need Flash 11. You've only got Flash 10, so click here to upgrade. Of course, it's not really Flash 11 because there is no Flash 11. It's malware. This is the one that got my brother. He was surfing around the web. I don't know where he was. And, you know, got a little pop-up saying, hey, we've detected your computer's infected with malware, so you can't come to our dodgy, suspicious site because you've got malware and you might hurt our defenseless little website. So go here, and they'll scan your computer for you for free, and they'll fix it for you. Well, what do? You go to the site, and they put all this convincing stuff up, and then you click install. And of course, that actually installs the malware that will then start annoying you and do crazy things to your system, and then after a while, it will ransom your system and say, hey, give us $50, and we'll fix that malware that we found, and, you know. And you think, who falls for this? There's an article in, I think it was Washington Post yesterday, $34 million per month worth of people fall for this at $50 a copy. Huge, huge, huge problem. So, try as we might, we haven't figured out how to patch the user. So what can we do that will help the user make a security decision in a better way? What can we do to get to the point where they recognize it as a boat full of alligators? Well, the first thing that we can do is maybe we can take the user out. And the way that we take the user out is we get a smarter user to make the decision. And for IE, this is about group policy. If you're in a corporate network, you can, as an administrator, set group policy controls that take away security decisions from your users. And this is okay. This isn't violating the law. Microsoft's not going to get sued because it's someone that's responsible for the machine that's making that decision. And so virtually everything in Internet Explorer is controllable via group policy, particularly things related to security decisions. So you can do things like treat certificate problems as fatal, block insecure content, prevent use of ActiveX controls, prevent installation of ActiveX controls, and prevent bypass of security warnings. We have 1,400 of those policies. But for my brother, it's not going to help. Nobody's managing his computer, although I'm seriously thinking about it. What can we do? Well, here's the download experience from XP. It's not much changed in Win 7. It's glossier and shinier. But here's what we show the user. You know, hey, do you want to run this file? Run, save, cancel. Here's the thing that's funny to me. While files from the internet can be useful, this file type can potentially harm your computer. It's kind of a mixed message. When I saw that message, I actually thought of some signs I saw in Hawaii. On the right-hand sign, it says, danger, no swimming. Very unambiguous, very clear, don't swim. Sign on the left is a little more interesting. Provides a bit more information. Strong current. Oh, that's why I'm not supposed to swim. But then it shoots itself in the foot, because at the bottom it says, if in doubt, don't go out. Which kind of implies, if you think you're a strong swimmer, you know, we're just giving you advice here. Go ahead. And that's much like the file download dialogue in Internet Explorer today. Hey, this is a file. Files can be bad, but also files do neat things. You decide. And so what we really are showing the user is this. Do you want to run the file or not? And chances are pretty good that the user is going to click, I'm feeling lucky, because, well, they went to the page in the first place. They want to see those scandalous photos, install that codec, or, you know, get their antivirus stuff updated. And so we have to get out of the model where, you know, this is happening. What's the answer? Well, the answer is to try and do something that's a little more bold. This is a different beach in Hawaii. It says, beach warning, do not go near the water. Unseen currents have killed. And then there's these little tick marks of the number of people that have died on this beach. Let me tell you, in contrast to the first beach, nobody was in the water on the second beach. And there's a couple of things that are really interesting about this sign. You probably can't tell, but the darkness of the tick marks is different. So I see that, hey, people have recently died on this beach. I'm giving this sign a lot more credibility than I saw the first ones. This sign looks like somebody, you know, who was really tired of pulling bodies out of the water finally threw up a sign, where the other one, it looked kind of like the Department of Public Works had a thing to go around every beach in Hawaii and stick signs in the ground. This is a really compelling warning. So how do we get to this? Well, we throw a lot of money at the problem. We're Microsoft. The money we throw at the problem is we fund a team called the Reputation Services Team. What the Reputation Services Team does is they go out, they buy data, they generate data, they investigate, and they find malware on the web. We leverage the networks we have, the SpyNet network that takes reports from Windows Defender. We look at reports from companies that do antivirus. We buy data from people that go out and crawl the web and find malware, and then we investigate things that are reported as malicious. Now, we're not quite so dumb anymore. We don't know, you know, whether every file on the internet is good or bad, but we actually know a huge number of the files on the internet that are bad. Once we have that information, we can say things with a lot more confidence. This is the warning that you get in IE8 when you actually try and download a piece of malicious software. It's pretty unambiguous. There's no, you know, clear, you know, run it anyway button. There is actually a link. The link says, you know, disregard, shoot yourself in the foot. Group policy can take that link away. That's a very good feature, and we would turn it on by default, except that unfortunately there's places where legally we couldn't do that. So, we've interrupted the user, prevented a clear and consistent warning that what they're doing is unsafe. We allow them to stop. I would love to be able to share the numbers with you. Apparently, the numbers are so good that they're doing a press conference at noon PST today to talk about how wonderful the numbers are, and I'm not allowed to share them with you. What I can tell you is that in the time of our beta alone, which was 4 months, we blocked 10 million malicious sites that were trying to install malware. So those were huge numbers from a pretty small user base. If you visit a site which itself is you know, going to try and give you links to multiple malicious sites or a site that's phishing and so forth, we actually just have a clear and unambiguous block page. One of the things that we got out of the academic community after IE7 was that our phishing page looked way too much like our cert error page. In the case of phishing, we have a pretty good idea that it's malicious or evil. In the case of cert error, we don't really know much at all. We know it could be evil, but we also know that it could not. Particularly in some universities that use self-signed certificates, it's never evil, and yet people see the dialogue all the time. So we worked with our folks in research and some folks in universities to come up with a much, much clearer message about, hey, this is actually known to be malicious. We provide you something to do instead. Go to your homepage. And then if you click more information, you can see lots of different things about, like, what is phishing, what is malware, and so forth. There is, at the very bottom of that section, a shoot myself in the foot anyway. But again, group policy can take that away. Then a bunch of features for cases where we just don't know. This doesn't help a user who doesn't know what the address bar is for, but somebody who's, you know, somewhat savvy about the web gets an easier way to say, wait a minute, this doesn't quite look like fidelity.com. In fact, it looks kind of like client 1999452.com. So we've made it a little easier for people to parse domain names, because this is something that's actually kind of hard for people that even want, people who know that they want to do. We've done extended validation certificates, now supported in all modern web browsers. There's over 10,000 top sites that support EV certificates. The goal here is to help users identify when they're on the site that is legitimate, the site that they think that they're on, not some, you know, cheap phishing site that was put together for an $8 domain name and a $12 domain validity certificate. The goal is about raising the bar, and EV has been fairly successful in increasing the cost and making spoofs not look quite so convincing. International domain names is a really interesting one because it's a success story that's been so successful that it's almost not even worth talking about. Basically, international domain names create a tremendous problem with spoofing, where I can go out and buy, you know, CyrillicPayPal.com, where PayPal, the A's are in Cyrillic A's. They look exactly like ASCII A's. There's no way for a user to look at them and visually know the difference. And so, you know, upon seeing this problem, other browsers took some reactive patching approaches. In IE7, when we first introduced IDN, we knew that we had to go out secure because basically we wouldn't be able to make changes after we launched. And so we took a very conservative model where basically we don't display Unicode characters to folks who don't have those languages in their character sets. You still see IDN talks where people are like, look at how dangerous Unicode is. Interestingly, you'll find that in those talks, well, usually they're abusing Internet Explorer. In those talks, they abuse other browsers. Because in IE, those attacks don't look very convincing. So you get an experience like this one down at the bottom where it's Citibank, but for a normal user in most of the world, they're going to see xn-itibnkxgag.com. And so this is a feature that we almost can't talk about because it was like, nobody gets attacked that way. Well, nobody gets attacked that way because it doesn't work very well. Let's talk about HPS for a bit, because I know this is a topic that's of interest in the research community and so forth, and it's also one of the big sticking points for us. So we still have a couple of sites that are doing the insecure login form. They have this idea of, oh, I'll just submit the page securely and it's going to be all good. Of course, in the case of an active attacker or a DNS poisoning attack or whatever, he can replace this form with the form of his choosing, so that's bad. And we've told people it's bad, and we've been yelling about it's being bad from the hilltops for 5 years now. Not everybody's fixed yet, but most are. Certificate mismatch. Here I'm picking on Microsoft.com in the hopes that they'll change it. But basically, you know, Microsoft.com is responding to HTTPS requests, and they're expecting to only get requests for HTTPS www.microsoft.com. So they send back a cert that only has the www version, of course. We look at it and say, this site's getting back a different security certificate, so we're going to block that. You know, it's actually pretty easy to fix this. Fortunately, some of the cheap registrars, GoDaddy, I think, being one of them, for $20, they give you a cert that has not only the www version of your name, but the www less one as well, so users don't see this. It's really challenging, right? What do we do here? Because we're delegating a decision to the user that we really don't want to. And the thought was, this will force all sites to do the right thing. Not so much. We still hit this. But it's done some. Actually, after we shipped IE7, I had a couple of people write to me and they say, Internet Explorer 7 has broken the web. And I say, what do you mean? And they say, customers come to my website and, you know, they check out and they get a big scary page and they stop buying from me and they yell at me. Why did you do that to me? And I said, but in IE6, we would tell them too. They're like, what do you mean? And I'd send them a screenshot of the dialogue that we used to show and they'd say, oh yeah, they just click yes on that. And it's like, well, okay, so pretty much for years and years and years, you've kind of not been doing security right, and now we're helping the user understand that. And they're like, yeah, stop doing that. Now, you think, oh, that's ridiculous. But the fact is, when the Firefox guys moved to a UI which is much like this one, they got tremendous amounts of pushback from their community. Oh, you're killing self-signed, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I want lots of advanced preferences. And so there's a huge amount of pushback because there's these competing interests. I want PKI with no central authority, and I know what I'm doing, versus most of the world, which is I like to surf from internet cafes, and I don't know what cert errors are. And so we have to find a balance. The last part. This is probably one of the most challenging things that we've done in the browser. Forever, Internet Explorer has warned the user if there's mixed content in the page, if they go to an HTTPS page that pulls in HTTP content. The idea here is that, well, you know, why would you want partial security? It's not really secure if there's a big hole in the bottom of your envelope where people can either look into the envelope or stuff stuff in it or take things out. And if you put in a mixed script, if you put in an insecure CSS or JavaScript within your secure page, you can compromise the security of the page. You could also stick an insecure image in there and change the image and tell the user, oh, by the way, your bank site is down. You need to call the following number and provide your account information. So we put in this warning. Well, the problem is the false positive rate on this is tremendously high. It's tremendously high for lots of amusing reasons that I won't bore you with, but lots of legitimate sites have this problem. And so users come to us and they say, why do you annoy me with this stupid dialogue? Make it go away. I'm like, oh, that's easy. Click here to block all mixed content forever. And then they do that, and then they contact me a couple weeks later and they're like, yeah, I don't like this much. I see red X's on my pages. I was like, well, what red X's? Oh, you know, nothing important, but they're red X's. I want those to go away. And I try and explain mixed content security, but they just don't get it. And this is a problem where, in the browser industry, we're kind of stuck. Because other browsers have taken a different approach than Internet Explorer. And so people say, well, I'll just switch to Firefox or I'll switch to Chrome because their user experience is less annoying because basically they'll mix content and just show kind of like a broken lock or something like that. And we say, well, man, we're getting tons of pushback from users, but we know this is the secure thing to do. Doing the secure thing isn't always the right thing. This is something that we're probably going to continue to try and figure out a better approach. Oh, this is kind of funny. So Opera will allow the mixed content, but they don't show the lock icon, or they show a broken lock icon. And if you click on it, they give you the little passive-aggressive message, the server attempted to implement security measures but failed. Which is kind of funny and kind of snarky, and I like it, but you know, it actually doesn't really do much for security. It does explain the problem pretty nicely and clearly, though, which I do like. Okay, cross-site scripting. On to the new stuff, the good stuff. So again, I mentioned at the beginning, I'm lazy. I want to give the best security bang for the buck available. And how do you do that? You pick the big attacks. Here's a survey of some security vulnerabilities done by a security research firm. They did it in August 2008, and they looked at all the classes of vulnerabilities they found on the sites that they audited. Cross-site scripting found in 70% of them, completely blowing away every other type of attack. Why do we care? Cross-site scripting is the new buffer overflow, according to Microsoft's Brian Sullivan. Not because it has anything to do with buffer overflows, but because everything that you would do against a client application, everything that you would want to get out of a client application with a buffer overflow, is the web equivalent. I can steal your cookies or your authentication information. I can log your keystrokes on websites. I can deface those websites. I can launch cross-site request forgery attacks. I can steal your browser history. I can evade site locking of ActiveX controls. I can circumvent phishing filters. I can circumvent HTTPS. Basically, if your site has a cross-site scripting hole in it, I can do all kinds of badness to you. Now, cross-site scripting is a server-side vulnerability. The initial thought is, well, server vulnerability, not client vulnerability, servers should fix. Well, I like that big 70%. I want to go mitigate that, because that would be cool. So for IE8, what we did is we implemented what's called a reflective cross-site scripting filter. And the idea is to address the dominant types of cross-site scripting attacks on the internet. So I'm going to give you a quick demo of that. So I'm going to go to my entry point for my cross-site scripting page. And then I'm going to go turn off the cross-site scripting filter because, as it turns out, at security conferences, when you do a demo and nothing happens, nobody's excited. Oh, so I've already turned it off for the practice for the demo, so I've turned it off. I'm going to click log into your account at Woodgrove Bank. I'm going to click account login. I'm going to type my secret information. Now, a real cross-site scripting guy is not going to reflect back to you, hey, I'm watching you and here's your password. He's going to send it off to his own server, right? But it turns out that if you do a demo and nothing visibly happens, the audience also yawns. So we have our nice little guy here. Okay, so let's go back to our entry point, and we're going to go set our security settings back to the defaults, which will turn on the cross-site scripting filter because it's on by default. Now we're going to log into our account at Woodgrove Bank. Now most people notice nothing meaningfully different. Some of the folks in the audience probably noticed there's a little subtle yellow bar at the top, and it says, Internet Explorer has modified this page to prevent cross-site scripting. Click here for more info. Notably, there is no shoot myself in the foot and turn it off. It's just, what's the risk? Why do I care? If I click on account login and I type in my information, we will find that there is no bad guy sniffing my page anymore. Well, how did any of this work? If you look at the URL of the page, you see all this hex-encoded garbage at the end. This hex-encoded garbage is actually, once you decode it, a little script block that pulls in a script from a third-party attacker's site. Internet Explorer 8 is smart enough to recognize when you're doing a cross-domain request, so you're navigating from one domain to another domain, and the outbound request has in its URL or in its post body something that is script, or something that is converted to script in a readily available way, like URL decoding and so forth. And if so, it doesn't block the request. If it blocked the request, ooh, we'd be in trouble. Compatibility. Instead, it waits for the response. If it gets the response back and it notices in the response, hey, your HTML, and hey, you have that script that you sent out, it very subtly changes that script so that it can't execute. If we actually view the source of this page, and I don't know if this monitor is going to be doing it justice, you will see at the bottom that you have this SC pound PIPT for window event on load source equals evil hacker site, blah, blah, blah. The key point of this string is that pound. It wasn't there in the original version. It was SCRIPT, which tells Internet Explorer, hey, pull in this third-party script. In the case of the cross-site scripting filter, it's recognized, hey, there's this reflected script. It's going to execute. That's bad. We're going to stop that. Rather than totally blocking it or doing anything else, we just make a very subtle modification so that it won't run. It's actually very, very tricky, and some very smart people worked on figuring out exactly how to sanitize this as simply as possible with the least possibility of impacting anything else. And this is really important. Turns out when we shipped this feature in Internet Explorer 8 Beta 2, there was a pretty significant bug in the code that determined whether or not something was cross-domain. This bug was so severe, in fact, that when you checked out from Amazon.com, we thought there was a cross-domain script being posted, and the XSS filter would fire. And in fact, we would sanitize part of the page. Now, there wasn't a cross-site scripting attack in that case, and so it was a false positive. If we had told the users, oh my gosh, you're under attack, horrible, go away, go away, go away, you can imagine that Amazon's legal counsel would be on the phone very quickly, and it would be a very, very bad resolution. But that's not what happened. In fact, virtually nobody noticed. Only a couple of people mailed us and said, hey, what's up with this? And the reason is because the thing that we had done to sanitize that reflected content wasn't harmful. Turned out it made no difference at all in the page that was returned from Amazon. And so we were able to make a very, very, very surgical security fix with minimal compatibility impact. We ran this across, I think, 4 billion pages or something to figure out, hey, even if this fires, what's the impact? Is the page broken? And it turns out the results were great. A lot of the earlier designs where we try and block or notify the user or do something or jump up and down and try and get credit for our cool security feature were rejected out of hand because the compatibility implications would be dire. Turns out there's still compatibility implications. We occasionally get mail from people that say, hey, e-commerce on my site doesn't work anymore. Users go to checkout and it's sent to this third-party payment site and your cross-site scripting filter fires and they can't check out. So far in all of them that I've looked at, there actually is a cross-site scripting vulnerability in the victim site. We have a way for a site to opt out, to say, don't protect me against cross-site scripting, I know what I'm doing, shoot myself in the foot. But for the most part, our advice to these guys is, well, let's help you re-architect your site so that you're not going to encounter this problem. And if you want to opt out of the protection, you can. We made it very easy to do so, but we're trying to improve the web security too. And this is really interesting, because not only are we responsible for protecting the user, we also have to protect the websites. And the cross-site scripting vulnerability is a mix of both. We want to protect the user, because it's usually their data on the website, but we also want to protect the website, because we don't want them to get abused by attackers. We make a lot of websites too, so it's not entirely not in our self-interest. Done a bunch more work in cross-site scripting prevention. We disabled US ASCII code page, which is this funky code page that allows you to easily hide attacks. We've disabled sniffing of the UTF-7 code page, same problem. We fixed a bunch of code page related issues. We've disabled the expression operator in standards mode for CSS, which is another vector that was unique to IE where you could do a cross-site scripting injection. And then we offered script sanitization functions for sites that are building mashups, and we'll talk about those in just a sec. Securing mashups. So one of the big challenges we have on the web today is people want to pull content from multiple sites and use it together in one page. Well, that's really challenging, right? Because that's almost the definition of a cross-site scripting vulnerability because of how mashups are built today. Mashups are built today in one of two ways almost all of the time. The first one is cross-domain script inclusion. You take my ad provider URL and put it in your web page, and I will draw ads on your page and pay you when users click on them. This is essentially a full trust model. I completely trust you, ad provider, not to do anything mean to me, poor innocent site that just wants money. Well, as you can imagine, this isn't suitable for all scenarios. The other type is iframes. I will allow you to put an iframe in my page, and I will rely on the fact that same origin policy doesn't allow that iframe to manipulate the outer page in most ways, and that will be my security model. The problem with this security model, unfortunately, is that iframe can do things like navigate the top-level browser window to a site that says, hey, we've detected you have malware. And that's how a bunch of the luring attacks for these fake antivirus programs work. They buy an ad on an ad network, and then they just redirect users from legitimate sites to the illegitimate site. So we need a better way to build mashups. In IE8, we did a feature called cross-domain requests. Cross-domain request allows you to do a HTTP request to a willing party on the other side that will return to you some content. This is the first part of a mashup, basically. I need to get content from the other site. without it executing. This is something that pokes a little hole in the same origin policy. It's very similar to the cross-site XML HTTP request that's been proposed and works in some other browsers. We use the same access control allow origin header syntax to allow compatible services on the server side. This is a case where it remains to be seen. Originally, folks came to us and they said, we want to do a cross-site XML HTTP request. And we looked at the draft at the time and we said, oh my goodness, that is horribly insecure. We really don't want to do that. And then we said, well, what's our counterproposal? What do we want to do? And so we came up with XDR as a mechanism of providing that minimal hole in same origin policy that allows sites to work together, but different programming model, much smaller attack surface, thought it was better. Turns out things are only better if people use them. So far, XDomain request has not gotten a lot of pickup, and unfortunately, no other browser has implemented it, although we continue to ask them to do so. Because it turns out web developers don't like new programming models. They like their shiny old program models with stuff layered on top. And that's what cross-site XML HTTP request is. It uses the same old XML HTTP request model, but allows cross-domain and certain syntax changes. So this is something that has not worked out terribly well. Fortunately, there's something that has worked out terribly well, and that's HTML5 post-message support. HTML5, draft specification, people are working on the various sections now. One of the things that was baked very early was a mechanism for iframes to communicate with other iframes through a consistent interface, which is easily secured. Basically, the originating iframe tells the other iframe, hey, here's something I want to tell you. And the receiver of that message is able to see who did it come from, examine the results, and do things to that result without script execution occurring. This is supported by all modern browsers, and it's something that we expect to be a pretty key part of most mashups in the future. So to send a post message, basically, you just find the frame, and then you call post message. One of the parameters you can say, and by the way, I expect this other site to be at the following domain. If it's not, please don't deliver my mail to anybody else. This is much more secure than the way the old mechanisms worked. And on the other side, you can easily say, hey, am I getting this message from somebody I'm expecting to get this message from? If so, act on it. If not, fail, security error. Now, there's a problem with this, right? We made it very easy to communicate between domains and more secure because both sides can examine the communication. But that only goes part of the way. And the reason it only goes part of the way is because what happens next? Very often in the model today, once you get the string of content from the other domain, you'll do one of two things. You'll either add it to your DOM, or you'll call eval on it. As soon as you do either of those things, you've essentially granted full trust to whatever you got from that other domain. So we've got some features around that. First thing, background, JavaScript object notation. It's basically a serialization to a string of a JavaScript object. Notably, any functions in it are not present. So if this JavaScript object had a function that does something, that function ends up getting stripped out when it's converted to JSON. So this allows you to build a data type which is safely communicable between domains without the possibility of script execution occurring if you were to happen to run it. Supporting that, we've got two mechanisms, JSON.stringify, which takes a JavaScript object and turns it into a JSON string, dropping all the functions and so forth, and JSON.parse, which is different than eval in that if you hand it a string that happens to contain a JSON object that tries to smuggle a function, it will just ignore the function. So these are basically native functions that are available. It was based on ECMAScript 3.1, which has been renamed to ECMAScript 5, I believe, or replaced with ECMAScript 5. It's natively supported in all the modern browsers, and this is something that allows for much safer communication of these types of objects between pages. Next thing, what if I want to get some HTML and put it in my page? Microsoft has long made available a library called the Microsoft Anti-Cross-Site Scripting Library. We've ported that to the client in this version, and we have a function called toStaticHTML, where basically you can pass in a string of content, and when you call toStaticHTML, we'll strip out the things that are potentially executable or misleading. That includes script blocks, ActiveX control references, anything that's CSS that might be changing the layout of your site and so forth. And so you're able to actually sanitize content that you get from a third-party site while still allowing some of the basic HTML tags. If you put it all together, you end up with, here's an implementation that actually allows two mutually distrusting parties to communicate, some HTML about the weather to and from each other and display it to the user without the possibility of script execution. So this is one mechanism by which you can actually make a more secure implementation of a mashup. done some other stuff around IE. One of them is mime sniffing. Internet Explorer previously was really, really eager to turn anything it got into HTML. This was really problematic if you wanted to host a service that would host arbitrary files, because that means that a user can upload some file that you think is a GIF file, and when IE gets it, it thinks it's an HTML file and will run the script. So IE8 won't sniff HTML out of anything that's marked as image WAXDAR, or for anything where the server says, don't sniff. And this is important because that means that, you know, we weren't willing in IE8 to take the compatibility hit of just turning off mime sniffing altogether. It turns out that some sites had depended on it. But it allows a site that really deeply cares about this problem and is aware and is doing the right things and setting proper content types to prevent IE from sniffing. This is used on some major sites now, and it's a great option. The guys who built Chrome and worked on the research behind Chrome did a great crawl of the web and looked for, hey, what are all the cases of mime sniffing really being necessary? And they did some great research on that if you haven't taken a look at it. For us, it's a little more challenging again because we've got that intranet case to care about. But this is something where we're definitely moving toward a more secure direction. We have a bunch of best practices. If you're building a site, hey, you know, use the new technologies, be sure to specify encodings. Use HP-only cookies. HP-only cookies were an innovation in Internet Explorer 6 SP1 and has now been adopted by all the other browsers. An HP-only cookie is only available and sent to the network. If you call document.cookie, it doesn't appear in that collection, which means that you've mitigated the impact if there is a cross-site scripting vulnerability. It can't easily steal your cookies. You do, however, at that point have a sock puppet browser that can be abused. Okay, let's talk about some design issues in the web platform, because this is, I think, the most interesting possibility for research, and it's the thing that we're looking at most closely as things like HTML5 come to pass. There's two of them that I want to talk about really quickly. The first is clickjacking, and the second is visited links. Clickjacking, you guys probably heard about, yes? Maybe? So clickjacking is this really interesting issue. So let's go to a very simple web page. Here's a very, very simple circa 2001 web page that allows you to buy some tablet PCs from that era. And the presumption for this demo is that I'm already logged in, and you know, they've licensed the one-click ordering patent from Amazon, and so all I have to do is click on a button and I've ordered a tablet PC. Right? It's a pretty simple design. User can decide how many they want and so forth. Okay, now I've kind of biased you, because now I'm going to send you to a different random site on the internet that wants to let you download avatars for your social network profile, and you've got kind of this weird cat guy and then a little dog guy. So if we go back to our little tablet store, you'll see that the layout of these sites is surprisingly similar. And in fact, the reason the layout of the sites are surprisingly similar is because this is a clickjacking attack. What's happened is the bad guy has layered his images on top of an iframe from the other site. When the user clicks, he thinks he's clicking on the site in the foreground, whereas in reality, he's clicking on the hidden iframe, which is layered behind this picture. And so in fact, I say, hey, I want this cat, and really what's happened is I've clicked on a background window and placed an order. Now, in some respects, this is kind of contrived, right? You know, hey, I can go reverse the order, not many places have one-click ordering, and so forth. Well, it turns out lots of sites will do various things if you click on buttons and links and so forth in them. Social networking sites will provide access to your profile to the calling API, or you could make somebody a friend, or you could start following somebody, and so forth. Clickjacking arises because there's this fundamental issue in the web platform. And the web platform is that you can freely mix together content from, you know, in frames from different sites, and there's really no way for a user to know that this is happening. It's funny, because I actually had the opportunity to talk to the guys who invented the inline frame, and I said, what happened? And they said, this came up in the threat model. It was 1996, and it was in the threat model, but nobody cared. Because there was nothing that you would want to do this for. It turned out later that there actually was an attack here, because Internet Explorer previously would allow you to mix file system folders into the web browser, and the attack was you'd mix in a file system folder in a subframe, and then you'd do misleading things around it, and then get the user to run executable programs. So they close that off, and they close that vector, but clickjacking, the nesting of frames from different sites, has kind of lingered, and it still is available today. And so Jeremiah Grossman last year kind of put together a really compelling attack where a user would go to a site and get clickjacked into reconfiguring Flash and providing access to his devices and so forth. It's tremendously compelling, but it's also extraordinarily difficult to fix. Because the web is all built about this notion of mashups and openness and so forth. We can't just prevent this from happening. We had a bunch of different ideas about, oh, maybe if the user clicks in a background frame, we'll notify the user. Well, first off, what do you notify the user, right? They don't know what a browser is. If you tell them, hey, you've clicked on a partially obscured inline frame, do you want to proceed? They don't know what you're talking about. And so ultimately what we did is we just made a slight modification so that a web page can say, you know what, I'm not allowed to be framed either by anybody or I'm not allowed to be framed by a third party. Now previously you had things like frame-busting JavaScript and so forth that would kind of emulate this, but in all browsers that we looked at, there were ways to circumvent frame-busting JavaScript. So this was a very minimal fix. It's opt-in. It was done very, very late in IE8 development. It's since been ported to Chrome and Safari. It's something that doesn't fully mitigate the problem, doesn't mitigate the widgets problem, for instance. If I want to have somebody else's widget occur in my page, that widget can't say don't frame me because they're intended to be framed. But turns out it's really hard to solve that problem. Okay, so that one's really pretty challenging to fix. We've made an approach. We allow websites to opt out of framing. The other one has kind of been around forever. Every 2 or 3 years it comes up. People notice that you can sniff where the user's been before. And so, in fact, I'm going to say, where have you been? And it's going to tell me, hey, I know that you've been to the New York Times, Bing.com, thanks, and Eric Law's IE Internals blog, thanks. And this page is running on debugtheweb.com. How does it know where I've been? Well, the answer is really, really boring and very simple. It just has some links at the bottom, and they have the CSS visited attribute on them that makes them red and big. And when you push the button, all it does is look at the links at the bottom of the page and say, are they red and big? If so, they've been there before. Well, this is really interesting. This is a simple fix, right? Don't do the visited link attribute. Well, that doesn't really work because then sites that depend on it don't work very well. Then you say, okay, well, just don't make it detectable. Well, it turns out almost everything's detectable. Maybe I don't use the CSS pseudo class for visited. Maybe I just say, hey, how much did the markup that was adjacent to this link move? And I set the visited attribute so that it makes the text really big. It's all detectable, and it's very, very hard to fix. There's a bunch of things you can do. One of them is you could try and isolate and say, hey, you can only detect same origin visited links, and otherwise the attributes aren't applied. I believe there's a research project from the Bartz and Jackson on that, or one of the two. Another is maybe you just allow the user to turn off link visiting, and maybe they don't care. But it's very, very tricky to fix this problem. In all the modern browsers, there's a relatively easy workaround, and that's all the modern browsers have either an in-private or incognito or off-the-record mode. And if you browse in that mode, it doesn't do visited link highlighting, and it also doesn't add those sites to your history. So either browse all of your trusted sites in this private mode, or browse only untrusted sites in private mode. In either way, you've created a logical partition that prevents that kind of detection. But for us, it's really tricky in the browser, right? We want to fix it, but there's really no fix because it's part of the spec, it's part of the design. And so we have to be very careful as HTML5 evolves and we add more and more capabilities to the platform that we don't create similar things that are basically impossible to fix. Privacy, I'm just going to blow through this because I want to let you have some question time. We've done some very simple things. Previously, when you uploaded a file, Internet Explorer would send along the full path to the file. Well, people would notice, hey, that's an information leak. Now I know that the user has a folder called c:\wac:\users:\wac:\desktop:\wac:\eric:\law:\wac:\desktop:\wac:\secret:\plan:\to:\compete:\with:\other:\browser:\wac:\foo.txt, and so I've leaked some information. All the other browsers just submit the leaf file name of, information.txt. Well, remember back when I said you can't do anything without breaking compatibility? Turns out this breaks compatibility with the most popular home router in the world. Because in this home router, when you try and upload new firmware, it looks at the file path that it receives and tries to parse it as a fully qualified DOS path. And of course it fails, because there is no fully qualified DOS path. Well, it's an easy fix, right? All they need to do is change the firmware on the router to make it so it doesn't have this dependency. How do you install the firmware? You can't, because you can't upload. And so ultimately, we ended up taking a bit of a compat hack here, such that when you look at this file path, we create a fake path. We took this idea from Opera with credit and gratitude to them, because they said, hey, here's a simple way to solve that problem. And so basically the server gets this innocuous sanitized path that doesn't actually exist, and we're able to circumvent the compatibility problem while still doing the privacy. We've offered an enhanced cleanup feature, so you can delete your browsing history on exit easily. We have that in private browsing mode, which I'll talk about in a second. We have the ability to preserve favorite website data, so that as you wipe out your website's visited history and so forth, you can preserve the data and cookies and so forth from your favorite sites. Makes it a lot less obvious when you've deleted your browser history. We've had people write to the blog and say, someone needs to tell, you know, my wife that sometimes history just goes missing because she sees that I have an empty history and assumes that I've been surfing naughty places. Well, this is a feature which is helpful for that scenario, but the feature which is more useful for that is in private browsing. In private browsing is an off-the-record type of privacy where basically we just don't keep local history, cookies, storage, and so forth for the sites that you visit while in that mode. And then we have a different feature called in-private filtering, which provides awareness and control of web profile aggregation. The idea here is that as you visit lots of different sites, very often they'll pull in a reference from a third-party server shown down at the bottom. Well, that third-party server gets a tremendous amount of context about where you've been, what sites you've visited, and so forth. Well, in IE8, we have a feature that allows you to essentially detect those third-party references and optionally just not make them. And so you can turn on in-private filtering and say, you know what? If Internet Explorer sees a third-party content reference for more than a user-choosable threshold number of sites, say 10, notify me and allow me to block that reference. And so I can block, essentially, web bugs from third-party sites. So are we done yet? No, clearly not. Bad guys are still out there and doing interesting things. I would be happy after the talk to chat with folks about what they think the security threats and so forth and the upcoming web platform are. But I just want to open it up to questions for now.
Hi, I'm Will Dorman with the CertCC. A short while ago, I was working on an IE exploit. And it was not completely reliable. It would work maybe like 20% of the time. The new feature in IE8 means that it keeps reloading crashing tabs. Uh-huh. Have you guys considered the security impact of that feature?
Oh, absolutely. So a clarification on Sadarov's talk yesterday. Internet Explorer recovers tabs only a maximum of 2 times. So essentially, if you're trying to circumvent ASLR, you get a max of 3 shots to do it. And also, if you do a dep NX crash, we will not recover the tab at all. And so if you're, in fact, attempting a jump to some other memory, unless that memory happens to be executable, you won't actually succeed, and IE won't try to automatically recover. If it's a non-dep crash, you'll get 2 extra shots. But for the most part, yeah, that's why the design was limited that way, and that's why we don't automatically recover from dep NX crashes. Next.
For the cases where you're giving the user, say, I feel lucky, or only do that if you really want to shoot yourself in the foot options, have you thought about popping up a virtual machine to do that action in, or other type of sandbox, so a do this, but do this safely?
Yeah. And so basically, the ultimate question is, shouldn't we mitigate the impact if something bad happens? And the answer is, man, that would be great, right? Like, it gets virtualized, nothing bad happens, and so forth. The problem is that you run into this sandboxing issue in general, where, well, what if the action was intended and allowed to be something that modifies profile and state that I care about? So if, for instance, I've downloaded the install program, which is the dominant, one of the dominant cases, where I want to install software on my machine, we could virtualize that and install that software into a virtualized machine, but then it's not going to quite work the way that I expect.
But you could give people the choice.
Oh, yeah,
you
absolutely.
You could say, I want to try this in a safe way, or no, really do this.
Yes, and so generally speaking, however, so we can't automatically do it, but the idea of giving the user an option is a fantastic one, and it's something that essentially Windows as a whole is looking at the more that we look at virtualization. This idea of sometimes there's things that I kind of don't really fully trust. Can we constrain access within Windows? And that's an area that is, I would say, under active research at the moment.
Cool.
Thanks.
Hi, so I suppose you could consider this a feature request. You talked about the no open option, which forces a download.
Yes.
So one feature that I have really, really wanted in a browser that I think Netscape 4 supported, but then it sort of went away, is I want this is text, so show it to me in the browser as text and don't parse it feature, which would be wonderful if you're downloading a LaTeX or a Python script and you want to see the script, damn it. And it forces you to download it and open it in your favorite editor, which is just annoying frequently. So if we could get that feature, that would be wonderful.
So is the idea that the website is telling you this, or you, the user, are saying, hey, don't interpret this or save this? Or
So it's commonly the server reports that it's application/Python or application/LaTeX file type, and the browser doesn't know how to deal with it, so it defaults to open it in a text editor instead of opening it in the browser, which is a wonderful text viewer for that sort of thing.
So ultimately, we don't have the feature. It's a cool idea. The one thing that we do because of our mind-sniffing work now is that at least if the server says, this is plain text and I really mean it, we won't say, well, that really looks like something else, so we're going to interpret it as something else. And so you can now share like HTML source code without having it render and so forth. Having the end user option is a cool idea, and it's something that I think we'll have to think about.
Hey, I've got a couple quick questions. One is the smart scan?
Or smart screen.
Smart screen stuff you talked about. Seems similar to like the Google Safe Browsing API, which Chrome, Safari, Twitter, and Google Search, and Chrome use. Except they offer an API for it, so everybody can benefit from that. Is the same thing true about Smart Screen?
Sadly, no. Right now, Smart Screen is not available to other callers other than Internet Explorer. We looked at what it would mean to do so. So one of the things that I mentioned and kind of harped on a bit was the idea that we're spending a lot of money. And so the problem is that we're spending a lot of money, but we'd be spending a lot more if we made it into an API. Right now, we have data licensing agreements from third parties where we're paying them for access to their data exclusively within IE. And so if we wanted to make it available to other applications, they would basically pretty much find themselves unable to sell their data to anyone, and so we would bear the full cost. It's one of the things that's been considered and thought about, because ultimately it's of course our goal to ensure that all Windows users are secure regardless of what browser they use. And so it's certainly something that has come up and we continue to think about. And in particular, one of the things that would be interesting is to understand whether third-party browsers, for instance, would even use those APIs, because they do have other APIs as well. It's something that I would like to do because we pretty firmly feel that we have the best data available, and it's just an issue right now about the relative cost. And then there is a minor implementation bit because backporting APIs to earlier Windows versions and so forth that are available to other apps would be kind of tricky. It would be a little odd to say, yeah, you need to install IE8 in order to get Firefox 3 to have this enhanced protection. But it's a great question. Thank you.
The other question was, some of the security features you mentioned were kind of, like, general. They didn't depend on the website changing what they did, or, like, the JavaScript developer or whatever. But some of them were, like, using, like, a Microsoft JavaScript API to do safe. And that kind of assumes that the user is going to be using Internet Explorer, right? So how do you feel about, like, mixing those two types of approaches? It's like,
basically, we have to. And the reason we have to is because if we're going to make something that's potentially a breaking change, we just can't do it automatically or by default, because then websites break, and then users don't install our browsers, and so forth. And so some of the features are entirely opt-in. Things where we think we can get away with it, and we've done a lot of testing, and we have high confidence that it's not going to break anything, like, for instance, the cross-site scripting filter, we'll just do it unilaterally. But if it's a breaking change, like the don't frame me, we have to do it on a specific opt-in basis. And so it is challenging, because you don't get the same uptake, certainly. In terms of the APIs that are specific or proprietary, we've certainly done work to try and evangelize and get other browsers to implement them. And so in particular, the content sanitization things and so forth. I think I saw a proposal, because there's already some open source libraries like HTML Purify and so forth that could readily be ported to provide that type of functionality within those browsers. And hopefully we will see that happen, because I think that there are things that every platform could benefit from.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Hi, I'm Mayank Upadhyay from Google, and the question I have is about backporting some of these security features to older browsers, right? In particular, there's a feature in SSL called SNI, Server Name Indication, which is very useful when you do virtual hosting, right?
Yep.
And from what I understand, there are no plans to support this in IE6 or on XP, in fact, at all.
That's correct.
And
so,
I was wondering what the story is there.
So the story there is that basically server name indication is a TLS extension that's available for doing HTTPS handshakes. Unfortunately, the way that that particular thing works is our entire HTTPS implementation, in terms of the crypto side of it, is provided by Windows APIs, not part of IE. So we don't actually even carry the DLL that does the actual crypto. And so that particular DLL is S-Channel. And S-Channel has a fairly high bar in terms of what they're willing to service for. So the only thing that has been serviced in S-Channel for XP recently, in the last few years, was they added new hash algorithms, the SHA-2 family, because essentially it was becoming a requirement and the breaks were close. Things like SNI were not part of that. There is, at this point, as far as I know, no plan to do further work in that area, which is kind of unfortunate. The counterpoint is, of course, that you know IE6 is a dwindling thing all the time, and there is some question if even if such an API or improvement were available, would the people that have IE6 even install it? Because clearly they've not installed a modern browser, to replace the one that they had. And so, unfortunately, that's not something we carry. And it's really unfortunate, too, because things like the AES 256 and so forth are also not available on XP. And so a lot of the HTTPS goodness is kind of frozen in time so that you need Vista and above to get it. Sorry.
Okay, thank you.
I had a question about the warnings and the executable files. So you have the blacklist of files where it'll show you the really bad warning. Have you considered doing any sort of whitelisting or offering an option where people could sign executable files and have something green that says this file is trusted, and have multiple levels of indicators for downloading those executable files?
So I think your question is can we do a sort of like this is safe list? And presumably it's a service in the same way that the smart screen reputation list is. Yes, we've considered it. Yes, we think it's a good idea. I don't think I'm allowed to say much more than that. But certainly the notion of, hey, you're doing a great job of flagging the known malware. How about you do a good job of flagging the known non-malware is certainly something that's come up a lot. And it is an important part of the overall strategy, where we're trying to drive an ever greater chasm between the things that are known to be good and the things that are known to be bad. So yeah, thank you. I've officially run over. I'm happy to keep talking if I'm not going to mess up recording and so forth, or you can just go grab me outside afterwards. Thank you.